The Tolkien Road, Episode 228, Tolkien's Modern Reading, an interview with Dr. Holly Ordway. Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 228, Tolkien's Modern Reading, an interview with Dr. Holly Ordway. Greta, how are you?
Hey, I'm fantastic. How are you doing?
I am doing well.
Good.
Read you loud and clear.
Good. Yeah. I'm glad. Yeah. I want to be read loud and clear.
Absolutely.
Yes.
All right. Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout out to our patrons. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Lise Yu, Andrew T, and our newest executive producer, John R. Thank you all so much.
Yes, thank you guys.
And a shout out to our newest patrons, including John R, as well as Jason T and David G. And for a boosted pledge from David Bigwood, longtime listener, longtime patron,
cool
David
beans.
Bigwood.
Nice.
So thank you guys.
Thank you, all of you. Yes.
You too can become a patron of the Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks, like early access to new episodes. Check it out now to learn more about all of the exciting perks we offer. And don't forget, you can now make an annual pledge and get 1 month free. On this episode, we are joined by Dr. Holly Ordway. Dr. Ordway is Fellow of Faith and Culture at the Word on Fire Institute and Visiting Professor of Apologetics at Houston Baptist University. She holds a PhD in English from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is the author of Apologetics and the Christian Imagination, an Integrated Approach to Defending the Faith, and Not God's Type, an Atheist Academic Lays Down Her Arms, and has contributed chapters to volumes such as C.S. Lewis at Poet's Corner, The Inklings and King Arthur, The Story of the Cosmos, and The Pivotal Players. She is also a subject editor for the Journal of Inkling Studies and a published poet. Her website is hollyordway.com, which we will link to in the show notes. She is also the author of the new book, Tolkien's Modern Reading, Middle Earth Beyond the Middle Ages. That's a pretty impressive resume.
That's a really impressive, impressive resume.
Holly, sure. Welcome to the show.
Yes, welcome, Holly.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Being here.
Our pleasure. I've been very excited for this interview. Had a chance to dive into the book a good bit so far, and you know, it feels like really something special. I'll just say that. So, and we're going to get into that. But Holly, we asked you to select this episode's Tolkien quote of the week, and you chose a good one. So from Fellowship of the Ring, this is the one you chose. "My dear Frodo," exclaimed Gandalf, "hobbits really are amazing creatures, as I have said before. You can learn all that there is to know about their ways in a month, and yet after 100 years, they can still surprise you at a pinch." So Holly, tell us why you chose this passage.
Well, it was difficult to choose a simple favorite because The Lord of the Rings is basically my favorite book ever. So mm-hmm. How do I choose a favorite? But then I thought, well, since we're talking about what I've been learning from his reading, I thought this really is apt because I feel about Tolkien exactly what Gandalf says about the hobbits, because I've loved reading Tolkien really as long as I can remember, since I was a little girl. And yet in the last 10 years doing this research, I found myself totally surprised by this whole sort of new dimension of him that made me admire him all the more. So I felt like exclaiming along with Gandalf, like, wow, you've surprised me, Tolkien.
Yeah, well, and that's, I certainly felt that way as I was going through, the first couple of chapters of your book. I was like, whoa, it's like there's some really fascinating stuff that you've uncovered here. Yeah, that's a good one. You got any thoughts on that quote there, Greta?
Yeah, and it's kind of one of those ones that it just makes you chuckle. And but it says kind of everything you really need to know about hobbits in just a couple of lines. I think it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it strikes me hobbits, it's almost like not just within the story and within Middle Earth itself, but hobbits on a level like Tolkien kind of discovered hobbits late into writing, but after he was well into writing the Legendarium of Middle Earth and composing it. And it's almost like he just discovered them and was like, oh, surprise. He surprised himself by
right?
discovering
the hobbits
them,
themselves were a surprise. Yeah.
Which seems like a very Tolkienian way of viewing things. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
All right. So Holly, before we talk about your new book, we always like to ask our guests about their journey with Tolkien. He's impacted so many on a deeply personal level. So tell us how Tolkien became a topic you were interested in exploring.
Well, that's, as I sort of briefly mentioned, Tolkien's really been a major figure for me, really my whole life, is not that much of an exaggeration. You know, I read his books when I was a girl and was just enthralled by The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. And interestingly, I encountered his essay on fairy stories when I was a young teenager. And although I didn't realize at the time, I think that probably did a lot to set me on my career as an academic literary critic, because I was loving reading Tolkien. I was loving, you know, what I was reading of fantasy. And here I literally stumbled across this battered old paperback copy. I still own it, actually. I've kept it as a bit of a treasure, where he's explaining his thoughts on the genre of fantasy, how it works. Mm-hmm. And to me, I must have been about 14. It was hugely mind-blowing, because I had just been reading and enjoying the stories as stories. And here was Tolkien doing this masterly job of thinking about, well, how does stories work? How does a writer craft them? How does the reader respond? And yet he does it in that essay in a way that doesn't dismantle the magic of the stories. It doesn't kill the interest in it. It adds to it. And as I was to discover as I went on in my, you know, graduate studies of English, that's not always the way of the literary
career. Right. Most definitely.
But I feel like Tolkien kind of both inspired me to be a literary critic and kind of inoculated me against the dismissive and dismantling aspect of it. So that, in a way, kind of is the seed that kind of blossoms out 30 years later.
Yeah.
Look, right. And along the way, I had done my doctoral dissertation on the history of the modern fantasy novel. And that I finished 20 years ago. So this has been steps on a long road, as we might say. And in that I had looked at the state of fantasy before Tolkien, and then how he had influenced the genre after it.
Mm-hmm.
And that really got me thinking, you know, after I finished that, I thought, well, I know now a lot about the context of The Lord of the Rings, what came before it. But I asked myself, sure. Gee, I wonder whether Tolkien knew any of these books. You know, had he read Morris and Dunsany and Edison? You know, how did he respond to these? Now, when I did that original scholarship, I was only looking at the genre as a whole. I wasn't looking at what Tolkien himself had read.
Sure.
I started to kind of wonder, you know, did he read any of these folks? And so that was what set me on really this journey of exploration. Say, well, what had he read and what did he think of it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great.
Good stuff. I know, I concur on fairy stories. I don't know when the first time I read that was. I think it was probably, probably like in my early 20s or something like that. And I just remember, I actually didn't understand a lot of it, because I hadn't gone through any, really formal academic training and literary criticism or anything like that. But I understood enough of what he was saying to where I was just like, yeah, right. You know, this is like, he has a totally different view of so many modern critics. Right. And kind of the way that people see storytelling now, it was like this thing that elevated the role of the artist, right, to this almost sacred thing. Right. And I was just like, whoa, no one, I've never read anyone say things like this, you know, about like artistic works, you know, about the process of creation. So that was certainly for me one of the, you know, early things that made me latch onto Tolkien in a deeper way than others as well.
Well, how seriously he took his art, you know, because he's not just, mm-hmm. you know, he wants to entertain, he wants to delight us, but that whole argument in On Fairy Stories about recovery, about how we return, we experience the fantasy story, but then we don't return unchanged to our own world. And I think that really gives some insight into his deep, deep sense of creativity. It's really rooted in reality. It's not just some little airy fairy thing floating somewhere else. He's really engaged with what it means to really to be human.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, the, what he says about escape, where I love how he takes issue with the, you know, like the modern critic who likes to, they turn up their nose at like, you know, it's they're like, oh, that's escapism, right? Fantasy is all about escapism. Right. And he's like, what's wrong with escapism, right? What's wrong with escape? What's wrong with escaping the jail, you know, the jail that you find yourself in this world, you know, the various prisons and enlarging your mind to the possibility that maybe that's not all there is, right?
And this actually, that particular passage was one of the things that helped me think about something important for my book, which is context. Mm-hmm. Because he talks about escaping from prison in a pretty favorable way, which is kind of surprising. You think, well, if you're in prison, aren't you being punished? But I thought, wait a second. He fought in the First World War. He was on the front lines, and he very easily could have ended up in a prisoner of war camp and spent years suffering in that, as some did. And in fact, one of the things I turned up in my research is that he actually, in World War II, helped to do a correspondence course of literature for mm-hmm. prisoners of war. He was very well aware of the fact that there were, you know, soldiers who had just been captured by the other side and were languishing in prisoner of war camps, far away from their family, their friends, maybe never going to get home. And I think when you understand that context, his remark about desiring to escape all of a sudden has quite a lot more relevance and resonance that we miss if we just think, oh, abstract, you know, jail.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, totally.
Well, that's so interesting because that, just as a little aside, that popped into my mind from, because I was in the Navy for several years. And I remember one of the things that I had to memorize was this thing called the Code of Conduct. And if memory serves, it's been a long time since I recited any of it, but if memory serves, like one of the things that I was bound to do if I ever found myself a prisoner of war was to do my best to escape. Right. Like it was like,
that was
duty.
Part of the code of right? conduct.
Like
wow.
you will, I don't remember the exact words, but it was almost something like I will do my best to, you know, to escape, you know, within reasonable terms. Right. If I ever find myself as a prisoner of war. Right. So yeah, I wonder if he had to take some kind of similar vow as a member of the, you know, British military as well in World War I.
Oh, that's a good thought.
Very, very probable. Yeah. And it puts a whole different light on that comment.
It really, really does. Mm. Yeah. It's fascinating.
Good stuff. Wow. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's talk about Tolkien's modern reading. From wordonfire.org/Tolkien. Tolkien's modern reading addresses the claim that Tolkien read very little modern fiction and took no serious notice of it. This claim, made by one of his first biographers, has led to the widely accepted view that Tolkien was dismissive of modern culture and that The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings are fundamentally medieval and nostalgic in their inspiration. In fact, as Dr. Ordway demonstrates in this major corrective, Tolkien enjoyed a broad range of contemporary works, engaged with them in detail and depth, and even named specific titles as sources for and influences upon his creation of Middle-earth. So Holly, like I said, I've made it a few chapters into the book so far, and all I can say is, wow, this book aims to address what you see as almost a caricature of Tolkien, that he was this fussy medievalist who utterly rejected everything modern. But you really show that that's a distortion of the truth. So tell us, you know, just tell us more about kind of in general what you discovered.
Well, it's been a kind of a fascinating journey because it's almost like this discovery has been hiding in plain sight because mm-hmm. I was working with a lot of published resources, you know, looking at his letters, looking at interviews, looking at the books that he's published, and seeing all these references to things that he had read. And yet I had this idea starting out 10 years ago that his authorized biographer, Humphrey Carpenter, says he read very little modern fiction and took no serious notice of it. Boom. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on, it's in the biography. Surely that must be correct. Surely, therefore, all of these things are just exceptions. And as I was going on, I just kept finding more and more and more exceptions. And then I kept digging beyond, you know, the easily accessible sources into, you know, interviews that had never been republished, you know, finding obscure articles that had an interview with Tolkien back in the 60s or even before, and dredging up these things, listening to and reading interviews with his family, with his friends, with his students. There are a really quite a lot of fascinating interviews that have come, you know, from the last few decades that are just tucked away in archives and places, in the Wade Center at Marquette, at the Bodleian. I was at the Oxfordshire History Center. You know, all sorts of places have got all these resources, people talking about Tolkien and mm-hmm. mentioning in passing, you know, this reference or that reference. I mean, as one small example, I listened to the audio recording of a talk that George Sayer, who was one of Tolkien's close friends, gave to the Oxford C.S. Lewis Society. And Sayer comments in passing that Tolkien thought very highly of the poet Dylan Thomas.
Mm.
That I have not found anywhere else except George Sayre mentioning it in this talk, which has never been republished. It's in the Lewis Society archives. And yet he says it as a perfectly ordinary thing. Like, oh yeah, you know, he thought very highly of Dylan Thomas. Like, whoa.
Yeah. Well, I know personally, like, I it's been years since I was kind of into Dylan Thomas, but not that I ever like kind of had a falling out with his poetry, but I remember like as a young man really loving, like finding a couple of his poems that I really loved. And now that I hear that connection, I'm like, I can hear something of like the spirit of the poems I loved of Dylan Thomas. I can hear something of that like in Tolkien's works. Like it's kind of a like the spiritual quality of certain things. So that's fascinating.
Yeah. So there were all sorts of things like that. And eventually I got to the point where there's just this gigantic heap of things that Tolkien had read and thought about, and a hugely wide range. I mean, he engaged seriously with James Joyce and Gertrude Stein, you know, modernists. He, you know, he read American realist fiction. He said that he read all the works of Sinclair Lewis, who was an American realist writer.
Yeah.
And that is as far different from fantasy as you can kind of imagine.
Yeah.
And I had this just big heap of things that he had read. And I finally realized these are not exceptions to the rule. There is no rule. And it made a lot more sense now because over the past, I'm going to say 20 years, there's been quite a lot of very good work on Tolkien and modern reading, individual scholars making individual connections. I've got a 14-page single-spaced bibliography in this book. There's lots of good scholarship that has been done.
Yeah.
That's been seeing the stuff that's been hidden in plain sight. But time and again, all of these scholars are viewing it as an exception. Like, oh yeah, Tolkien didn't really take notice of modern fiction, except for this one cool connection.
Right.
There is no rule. These are not
like,
exceptions.
There's a lot of exceptions.
Yeah.
Maybe this isn't actually the rule.
Exactly. And so one of the things I did, you know, in addition to sort of trying to assimilate all the masses of biographical and interview material, I tried to assimilate as much as possible of the scholarship on Tolkien's engagement and finding some great insights from my fellow scholars that had been just kind of not pulled together because everybody thought it was an exception.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, because there's no consistent picture, meanwhile, as soon as you step outside that little core of Tolkien scholarship of the past 20 years, boom, everybody thinks he's stuck in the past, fuddy-duddy, frankly. And I saw, like, you know, popular books, even frankly academic books that treat with him, they assume that of course he didn't read anything after Chaucer. It's I mean the biopic
because Tolkien, he's a medievalist. Everybody knows Tolkien's a medievalist, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, as if you couldn't possibly read anything outside of your field. Heaven forbid that any of us should do that.
Right.
Yes.
So it's kind of a two-part project in a sense, which is to say to my fellow, you know, scholars to say, hey, let's bring this together. These things you've discovered, these insights are not exceptions. Let's pull them together and have a complete coherent picture so that it can be more meaningful. And then to the wider, you know, reading world to say, hello, this picture that you think you have is really one-sided.
Yeah. Kind of myopic. And, you know, the more I listen to you talk, Holly, I'm thinking about the comment you made about hiding in plain sight. When you think about it, just on a very practical level, it doesn't really make sense that he wouldn't have read other things. Because you think about any kind of artist, be it a musician or culinary, you know, chef, whatever, that was culinary artist. Anyway, when you think about any of that, they find their influence somewhere. And to not, you know, and to not look elsewhere for that influence, it's really to be kind of stuck in a very narrow mindset, and it hurts your literature. So I don't see, and your cooking and your music and everything. So I don't see how Tolkien could have created something as magnificent as The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion and all those things without having read other types of literary works. So.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things you mentioned on that note, one of the things you, I, I think the term you use, Holly, in chapter one is influenced by opposition. Is that right? Or am I getting that term right? But basically the idea is that there's this such a thing as not only being influenced by something that you really enjoy or love, but something that you like look at and like, not that. I don't want to do it. I don't like that. Right.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And that was one of the things, you know, and looking at this, I had to look more broadly at what do we mean by influence? Because Tolkien very famously has some kind of harsh words to say about source hunting. And so one of the things I needed to come to terms with is, well, am I endeavoring to do something that Tolkien himself would have disapproved of? And, you know, that doesn't mean I couldn't do it, but I had to grapple with what he himself said about it. And what I came to realize is that there's a certain kind of approach that looks for sources and treats them as if you find a source, therefore it just appears, boom, in his work, you know, copied and pasted, so to speak. Well, no, he doesn't work that way. He very rightly rejects the idea that he just is like a rubber stamp, you know, picking up an idea and boom, putting it in his work. But I mean, you know, any artist knows that that's not how influence works. If you're actually as a writer myself, as a poet, that's not how influence works. And so I tried to think through what is influence and how does it work? And that's where I came up with some different ways to talk about it. You know, sources are things where he's actually taking an idea, a character, something and using it, which isn't to say that he takes it as is. I mean, one of the things that's exciting about Tolkien is the way that he transforms his source material. You know, it's just striking. He might pick up an idea from, say, William Morris or Rider Haggard, and you can see, I see that this provided an idea, but wow, look at what he did with it. Look at how he mingled it with other influences in his own creativity.
Right.
And there are influences where he's picking up something where there's a style or an approach to something that shapes the way that he's working on it. And then, as you just noted, there's influence by opposition, which doesn't get as much attention as it should, because when you are going in a direction and something causes you to change direction, that's a pretty big effect on where you're going.
Yeah,
right. Yes.
Influenced by opposition in his work, where he reads something, again, because he read widely, he reads something, doesn't like how it's done, and he's such a perfectionist. You know?
Yeah.
I can do this better. Or
only took him 17 years to publish the sequel to The Hobbit, so, you know.
Yeah, seriously. So we see quite a lot of that, and that was really interesting to trace. Now, obviously, when you're tracing influence by opposition, you're looking at what isn't there. And so necessarily, you have to be cautious. And I'm sure that some of my arguments in terms of specific influences could be improved or argued with. But he does indicate in many cases that he read something and felt, nope, this isn't good enough. Like there's a famous wager, called a wager, although there was no betting involved, with Lewis about science fiction. And this is one of those hidden in plain sight things. It's well known. They have this thing, well, there's not enough in science in current, you know, fiction that we like. We'll need to do it ourselves. And then Lewis writes Out of the Silent Planet, which, by the way, Tolkien loved and helped to get published.
Yes.
And Tolkien being Tolkien, he starts a work that he never finishes. But that's well known as part of this, the origin of Out of the Silent Planet and the origin for The Lost Road. But then we have to stop and say, wait a second, what's the context here? Lewis and Tolkien are talking about their reading of modern literature. And they are agreeing there's not enough of what we like, which means they've read widely, that Tolkien has read widely enough to know that what he likes isn't being done.
Yes.
Only if he knows the field widely would he be able to make that statement. And so that is influenced by opposition, even if we never identify a specific title or handful of title that he was thinking of. He probably wasn't thinking of a specific title. He's like, you know, there's nothing currently being published that does what I think should be done, therefore I'm going to do it. I found out, actually, this was one of the surprises. He actually read very widely in science fiction. He liked Isaac Asimov. He liked Ray Bradbury. You know, a lot in that field. But we've tended to just kind of skip right over that statement that, if we think about it, it's phrased reversely, if that's a word, it is now. We miss the fact that there isn't enough of what I like means I've read a lot in this field.
You're absolutely right. You have to be informed to be able to make that statement. You have to know what's available.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's go back to Carpenter. So you mentioned Carpenter a little while ago, and we recently did a series, a four-part series on the life of J.R.R. Tolkien, and I used Humphrey Carpenter's biography as my main source for that research. And we've also heavily utilized Tolkien's letters, which Carpenter edited. In the first chapter, you, I think you pay due respect to Carpenter, but you kind of take him to task as well, which I was surprised by. But once I was done, you know, with the chapter, I was like, wow, you were right. So tell us more about what you uncovered when it comes to Humphrey Carpenter and his work as his biographer and the editor of his letters.
Well, I want to say, first of all, that I started off assuming that Carpenter was the authority because he is the authorized biographer. And okay, yeah. And he is the only author so far to have open access to the Tolkien papers. But here's an interesting thing, and it's a bit of a tip off. There are no citations in the biography. He doesn't give any sources or details or even often dates for the information that he provides. He just makes these statements. And one of the things that I started to ask myself is when I found all of this evidence that Tolkien had read widely in modern literature, I thought to myself, but Carpenter says flat out the names in modern fiction meant little or nothing to him. No, Carpenter says he read very little modern fiction and took no serious notice of it. No, that's just factually incorrect. I've got the data from Tolkien himself naming all these people. And so I just thought to myself, what is going on? How did Carpenter get this mistaken idea? And so I went and started looking at interviews with Carpenter. What did Carpenter himself say about his work? And I was really surprised by what I found. First of all, I found as I was looking through this, that his hiring as the authorized biographer is not what I had imagined. Reading an account by Rainer Unwin about the publication of the biography, they had actually hired a completely inexperienced Carpenter to help write the captions for the book that eventually became the Tolkien family album. And Unwin even said in this account, yeah, we writing captions, you don't need any real experience or qualifications for that. That's how they hired him. And then Owen says Carpenter dug himself in. Now we switch over to Carpenter. He was in an interview asked, how were you chosen to be the authorized biographer? And Carpenter says, well, I wasn't really chosen. I rather forced myself on the Tolkien family.
Oh, wow.
And he says that he went around to them, to each of them, and said, hey, I at least know Oxford a bit. I know I've met Tolkien a bit. His connection with Tolkien, by the way, can be very overstated. He didn't know him well at all. So I know Carpenter, I know Oxford a little bit. I know the milieu. If you don't get me, you'll probably find a worse biographer coming along. This is Carpenter.
What a sales pitch.
Yeah. So I thought, wow, that's astonishing.
Yeah.
And then looking at later interviews that Carpenter made, he makes snarky remarks about Tolkien. He calls his academic field a dead subject. He called his upbringing uptight. He even admits that his first draft of the biography was written in a slapstick mode. That's Carpenter's own description.
Wow.
And then we find, again, turning to Unwin's account of it, that the first draft of the biography was ripped apart by Christopher Tolkien, sent back to Carpenter. And then Carpenter dealt with it in about a week or so. Which, by the way, speaking as an author, it takes more than a week to address serious revisions, let's just say.
That sounded fast to me as a completely non-writer.
Yeah. And then Carpenter later said that what he had done was he had just, quote, castrated the book, cut all the sections that were,
controversial. Yeah. Potentially controversial. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is, okay, this would cut things that were just completely off base. But if his whole attitude towards Tolkien is one of sort of disrespect, disregard, here's this old fuddy-duddy, slapstick, uptight figure, there's going to be a lot, not just in what he says, but how he says it and what he leaves out that is going to shake the picture. Now, back when the biography came out, the Tolkien family had no idea that that their, you know, their father is going to become this massive literary figure, and that this biography is going to become, you know, the cornerstone of Tolkien scholarship. I can quite understand why they were kind of like, yeah, okay, fine, whatever, publish it. It's okay. But it wasn't kind of okay in the sense that it's really shaped what we think about Tolkien. And his relationship with C.S. Lewis is, I think, one of the points where we can actually track down with some pretty good accuracy where we see the distortions. Because I'm also a Lewis scholar. I mean, I've been working with C.S. Lewis's work for years. And this question of what did Tolkien really think about Narnia is something I get asked about all the time. I mean, you see it everywhere. Tolkien hated Narnia. He loathed it. He thought it was as bad as it could be. And, well, where did that come from? So I set out in that section in Tolkien's Modern Reading, and I set out to say, well, what did Tolkien really think about Narnia? Well, first of all, there's a letter that Carpenter does not include in the collected letters, which is published by a later scholar. Tolkien actually says he calls Narnia deservedly very popular.
Deservedly. Oh. Well, how about that?
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned that he kept a copy of the Narnia Chronicles on his bookshelf and in his study for when his grandkids came, because he would be like, hey, here's some books for you to read, you know?
Yeah. And Tolkien was a very dedicated father and grandfather. I mean, he was really attentive to his grandchildren and to their reading. There is no way that he would keep copies of these books if he disapproved of them or if he thought they were rubbish. So this is actually firsthand from his granddaughter Joanna, who recalls, you know, being handed these books. Here, read the Chronicles of Narnia. You know, Tolkien himself admits that he doesn't care for them. Okay, different tastes, you know, but he calls them deservedly very popular, and he says to the recipient of the letter, he's glad that person has discovered Narnia. Mm-hmm. When I encountered that letter, I thought, whoa, there's something is mistaken here. So I went and I did quite a nerdy and painstaking tracing back what are the first accounts of Lewis's reactions and Tolkien's reactions. And it turns out that Tolkien had only heard the first couple of chapters read aloud to him of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and he didn't care for it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And he makes some kind of snarky comments about the fact that, you know, Mr. Tumnus has these books, you know, oh, the love life of a faun and nymphs and their ways, you know, basically what is, you know, Jack going on about. And that has gotten blown up. Because he says, oh, that just won't do. Mm. And Carpenter, although he knows that this is the context, Carpenter includes the full quote in the biography that when Tolkien says this just won't do, he's referring to the scene, the books on Mr. Thomas's shelf. Carpenter actually, when he does his Inklings biography, he cuts that part of it, and he makes "it just won't do" refer to Tolkien's view of the whole Narnia series, which is not what Tolkien was referring to. When he made that comment, none of the Narnia books had even been published. He'd only heard the first two chapters or so of the first one draft.
Interesting.
So Carpenter, although he knew better, actually makes it out to seem that reference, "it just won't do," refers to the whole published Narnia Chronicles. In fact, Tolkien's "it just won't do" comment, well, for one of the things I tracked down in my research is that Tolkien had a very sort of hyperbolic way of expressing himself. He loved to exaggerate, and then he would back down. And reports of the Inklings meetings always refer to them as being very lively, you know.
Sure, yeah.
So for him to say kind of an exaggerated way, "oh, that just won't do," is perfectly in keeping with him just kind of giving Lewis a hard time. Mm-hmm. Also, he's got a point, because the whole idea of like nymphs and their ways, you know, that, and the fact that Mr. Tumnus is a faun, which in Greek and Roman mythology is associated with like sexual aggression, a kind of a dicey character for a children's book, where all that Tolkien has thus far seen is little girl Lucy being invited to have tea with Mr. Tumnus.
Oh.
Okay.
Who has you know, nymphs and their waves on his bookshelf. And Tolkien has a daughter, and Lewis does not have any children, nor stepchildren at this point. Mm-hmm. So I think it's perfectly reasonable that Tolkien thought, Lewis, he knew perfectly well that Lewis knew his classical literature as well as he did.
Yeah.
He probably thought it was a little dicey, a little risque. Mm-hmm. Now, we now know that Lewis handled it perfectly fine and deals with it. In fact, he addresses that kind of question in Prince Caspian. And the fact that Tolkien then, you know, gave these books to his granddaughter to read, I think shows that he eventually thought it was at least okay. So it's a very much more specific point. Now, did he enjoy the Narnia Chronicles overall? It seems not particularly. He didn't enjoy that sort of mixing of mythologies. Mm-hmm. He didn't like Father Christmas coming in, but neither did some other folks who were reading it in draft.
Sure.
And Lewis himself just says, no, yeah, you know, Tolkien didn't like it. We don't get any sort of sense of devastation or anything from Lewis. That gets picked up later as the story keeps being retold with additions.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
So, yes. You know, it kind of casts a new light. And since this has had a lot of influence, there are people who actually claim that Lewis and Tolkien's friendship was devastated by his hatred of the Narnia Chronicles. Like, no, it had nothing to do with it. He didn't hate the Narnia Chronicles. He didn't right. care for them. Very different thing.
Mm-hmm. Folks, I just have to say, this is for those who are listening, watching, this is good scholarship right here. Like this is what good scholarship sounds like, when, you know, taking a close look at things that are kind of like commonly accepted and, you know, assumed to be true, and then taking another closer look at them and being like, wait a minute, is that really what was happening? Is that the full context? Are we getting an edited version? You know, these sorts of questions. I have to say that, because this is really good stuff. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that also impressed me, and you've done a little bit of this so far, but you really are careful to define your methodology from the outset. You talked a little bit about that before, defining terms when it comes to influence and that sort of thing. But one of the key terms here is obviously the term modern. So tell us more about your definition of the term modern, your working definition of the term modern in your research.
Yeah, well, I had to pick a starting point somewhere. And so I picked 1850 as my cutoff point for modern. And of course there were, you know, works before that, the Rinchting and, you know, modern-ish, but 1850 is a pretty customary mark in literary criticism for the modern era. You know, death of William Wordsworth, publication of some of the major novels of the Victorian period. We also have, you know, railroads and industrialization are really kicking in. There's also when the Catholic hierarchy is restored in England. So there's a lot kind of going on culturally around the 1850 mark that make it a pretty useful mark, both literarily and culturally mm-hmm. for modern. And it's also, you know, Tolkien is born in 1892. And so 1850 is a date where things would published then or after would have been modern for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though that's several decades, you know, for us, that might seem like a long time, but the pace of publishing and the pace of media was much slower in Tolkien's mm-hmm. youth than it is now. So the books that were published in 1850, 60, 70, 80 would have still been part of the modern recent books of Tolkien's own childhood. And so that was another reason why it was a good cutoff point for for modern.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Makes sense. Yeah. Well, there's, I know you mentioned in passing, and I don't think I've gotten to this portion of the book yet, but one of my favorite works of children's literature is The Wind in the Willows. And I had known that Tolkien, you know, was aware of it, maybe somewhat influenced about it. But what did you discover about, you know, Tolkien's relationship with The Wind in the Willows?
Well, I discovered he loved it. He called mm-hmm. it an almost perfect blend of many pigments. He praises its excellence. He simply loved it. And even made sure to get, there was a copy, a book published, it was called First Whisper of Wind in the Willows, that had early drafts of what became Wind in the Willows. And he got a copy of it. So here we have Tolkien interested mm-hmm. in the sources of a book that he enjoyed, which I just think is cool.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And this actually, it's interesting you mentioned this in line with talking about Narnia, because I actually kind of pair these in that chapter, because the fascinating thing is that The Wind in the Willows has a lot of the same characteristics as Narnia. It's a blend. We have the animal characters, you know, Toad and Mole and Rat and Badger, and yet they have adventures at certain points in human settings. and you know, they wear clothes and yet they act like animals. So it's an odd kind of blend. And yet he loved it. He didn't care for the chapter on Pan, Piper at the Gates of Dawn. He felt it almost spoiled the effect. But he loved the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting to kind of consider his reaction to Wind in the Willows and his reaction to Narnia, because I think it helped to kind of clarify the picture. What exactly was that he didn't like about the mixing of mythologies? Because you've got a mixing in Wind in the Willows, which he loved, and you've got it in Narnia, which he didn't love. So what was going on? And, you know, this is a big question. I hope more people look into it. But I think part of it had to do with the fact that it's much more kind of blended in Wind in the Willows. There are no sharp, you know, there's no sharp delineation. There's lots of sharp, distinct shifts of mythologies in the Narnia books. I myself don't have a problem with that. I love the Narnia books. I differ with Tolkien in that respect. But it's a different flavor. It's a different way to bring them in. Mm-hmm. And I think that Tolkien probably just liked some of the features of Wind in the Willows better, the Oxfordshire landscape, for instance.
Yeah.
I mean, we know in the Narnia books, one of the first characters we meet in Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe is the White Witch, who is straight out of Hans Christian Andersen's, you know, Snow Queen, very much a figure borrowed from that. And we also know that Tolkien really disliked the fairy tales of Hans Christian Andersen. He just detested them. So a lot of that reaction that Tolkien had to not caring for the first chapters of Narnia probably had to do with the fact that Lewis is drawing on materials that Tolkien just doesn't care for. And so I think it helps to sort of compare those two. It gives us, I think, more of a textured and detailed picture of Tolkien as a literary critic.
Yeah.
That's so interesting that he didn't like the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, the chapter on Pan, because I remember when I first read Wind in the Willows and that chapter shows up, I was just like, it just took it to a whole new level. I was already really enjoying it. And then it was just like, whoa, like this thing is mind blowing. I just remember reading that and just the descriptions of just that whole interaction were like revelatory for me. I don't know. I'd never read anything like that. But I can understand too, So I guess it would be interesting for me to hear more about why Tolkien had that reaction to that chapter, but that's probably a topic for another time. But I like the whole compare and contrast Narnia and Wind in the Willows, because I too am a fan of Narnia. I mean, Narnia was, you know, that was my first love, right? But I totally understand too Tolkien's criticism of it. And you know, it is like sometimes it feels a little like you just kind of have things that just boom show up out of nowhere, right? You know, and it's certainly meant to be a different type of work, but Wind in the Willows has that much more kind of organic flow to it. Even to where for me, like when it does show up with the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, it feels both supernatural and organic at the same time. You know, it doesn't feel unnatural or like it's this weird interjection.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this kind of gives us a clue as to, you know, Tolkien's own creative preferences, because I think his objection to the Piper at the Gates of Dawn is not so much the material, but the fact that it is a shift in tone. And then it's just back to the other tone. And Tolkien is just really big on consistency. I mean, this is why it takes him, you know, decades to publish things. He's niggling. Mm-hmm. He's always getting at these. He wants it to be smooth and seamless so that there can be no joints showing at all, even possibly. And I think that helps us understand some of his own creative decisions. You know, why does he spend so much time, you know, adjusting the phases of the moon in The Lord of the Rings? You know, he's really concerned that there be absolute seamlessness in his creations. It's one of the reasons that he never in his lifetime was able to produce a finished Silmarillion, because he couldn't reconcile the way that he handled the shape of the world. Is it a flat world? Is it a round world? He had two different versions of that in his mythology, and he couldn't figure out how to resolve it. And he just couldn't bring himself to publish it unless he had resolved it. And of course he kept publishing it as well. So I think in seeing the way that he reacts to these different literary works, it does show, what does he value?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I kind of want to play devil's advocate here for a minute, because mm-hmm. when you were talking about Pan and kind of that surprise and how, you know, Tolkien prizes seamlessness, I had Tom Bombadil pop into my brain, and I was thinking, that's kind of a surprise. That's a little bit of a deviation from that seamlessness. Yeah.
That may be one of the criticisms of Tom Bombadil.
It could be. Yeah. So it's just interesting to me to think about. I agree. I mean, he was a perfectionist, and he spent years researching and making sure all ends were, you know, that what ends he wanted tied up were tied up and everything. But then there's still this mystery of Tom. So I kind of wonder if maybe he didn't play by his own rules every now and then, but...
You know, I think you're absolutely right. And again, you know, Tolkien is such a multifaceted creative thinker that I almost get the sense of him sort of trying to restrain his own creativity, and then it just bursts out and he can't help himself.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I think there's a part of his personality that's very much wants everything to be perfect and polished, mm-hmm. but his imagination is kind of too powerful for his reason to keep it.
Right. And I love that. I love that, you know, that idea of Tolkien. I think it just adds one more layer to, you know, just to the man that he was.
A neat example of that, if I can interject here.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
Again, kind of related to Lewis, because the ants, Treebeard and the ants, they pop out of nowhere. He even says he's riding mm-hmm. along and boom, here they come. And where did they come from? And he's even not even sure himself, where did they come from? And then he has to kind of work on how do I figure them out? And here's an interesting thing. In some of his notes for The Lord of the Rings, he actually has a page of notes about Treebeard. Treebeard has popped into being, and he's making some notes trying to figure out, who is this character? How do I fit him in? He's not even sure if he's a good guy or not at the beginning. What on earth? And here is a really cool thing. I think it's cool anyway. He asks, are the Treebeard Hnau or not? And the word Hnau, H-N-A-U, that Tolkien uses, is a word from C.S. Lewis's book, Out of the Silent Planet. And Lewis invents this word to describe non-human, rational, moral beings. So in his own notes, Tolkien is using Lewis's concept of Hnau to say, are the Treebeard and the ants, are they trees that have become Hnau, or are they Hnau who have degenerated into trees? So he's using Lewis's own concept to help him think through the identity and nature of the ants. And I think there's some really cool connections with the Sorns. Once you see this, Treebeard is actually quite a lot like Ogre in Out of the Silent Planet. There's some real connections there. And the fact that Tolkien is using this concept from Lewis's science fiction to help him figure out this creature that popped into my book, what is it? He's drawing on an influence from Out of the Silent Planet to help him figure out how to shape his own creatures. Like, that's really awesome. Fascinating.
That really is. That's very cool.
Yeah. It's, when you were, you know, talking about like that the problem we had with the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, I was just like, man, that's the pot calling the kettle black, right? It's like, Tolkien did that. I mean, you know, and he was always careful to do it in as seamless a way as possible. But it also strikes me that like the number one quality that he calls out at the end of On Fairy Stories is like being the thing about that makes fairy stories so wonderful is this eucatastrophe, right? Like this like moment of the happy turn, like this surprise, right? And his works are filled with those kinds of moments. So, and I would, you know, I mean, the meeting Tom Bombadil is not exactly that, but it's kind of a mini version of that because Tom Bombadil is the one that rescues them from Old Man Willow, right? And, you know, the Ents rescue, you know, kind of show up at just the right time for Merry and Pippin, and then for the rest of, you know, what's going on in Rohan and Isengard. And, you know, so it's like, yeah, it'd be interesting to, you know, when Tolkien made that, you know, made that criticism of Wind in the Willows, and then maybe later in life, looking back, would he have been like, okay, I can understand where Kenneth Graham was coming from now.
And actually, that's a really good point, because there's a lot of that in Tolkien's, in his writings and interviews. He does that often. He makes a very strong statement, and then later on he nuances it. His personality was just that way. And I think, and these comments about Wind in the Willows are in one of his drafts for On Fairy Stories. So he's thinking out loud. So I think that this tendency to kind of overstate the case very firmly and then kind of pull back and reconsider is a dynamic that really hasn't been appreciated enough in the way that we understand Tolkien. He just had a very exuberant personality. And there was a lot of that kind of give and take of you know, bursting out and then kind of recapping, retrenching, saying, well, what did I really mean? While at the same time, paradoxically, he's so English, he's so self-deprecating, and he's so modest about the things that really matter to him. So we have this curious combination of a kind of reticence and self-deprecation combined with his willingness on some topics to be really hyperbolic and exaggerated.
Right.
And we get the development over time where an idea that he has early on, that isn't necessarily the way he thinks through the whole of his life. He matures as a creative writer. He has new thoughts. You know, The Hobbit becomes The Lord of the Rings, you know, in a sense of, you know, becomes and leads to, you know, there's a very definite shift in tone. You know, The Hobbit is very much a children's story. It's a marvelous children's story. But The Lord of the Rings is very much a book for adults. But it didn't start that way. He started out to do a sequel to The Hobbit.
It was The New Hobbit, right? It was Hobbit Part Two.
Having this sense of him as a complex personality that we have to resist pinning him down, that was one of the big insights that I drew out of this. Like, he is just really complex as a personality and as a creative mind. And I think if we can just kind of keep hold of that, it will really help us understand him a lot better.
And it takes a mind like that to give you a work like The Lord of the Rings. I mean, like, don't even get started on the Silmarillion itself. I mean, and the entire legendarium, right? All of its riches. It takes a mind that, you know, that you've described to give us those kinds of works. Even The Hobbit itself, right? I mean, The Hobbit within itself changes tone over the course of the book. Yeah. And then the first edition to the second edition, vast edits that changed, you know, the tone of the book. I mean, On Fairy Stories almost feels like, and sometimes it almost feels like he's criticizing The Hobbit, right? In a couple of cases, right, where he's basically like, why do we think that, like, fairy tales are about, like, these winking asides at children and everything, right? You know, it's like no, like, these are stories about the perilous realm, right? Yeah. So,
and he even specifically criticizes The Hobbit in some comments for that exact thing. He says that he regrets some of the little kind of cutesy things that he put in. He's very self-critical in his own work.
Several episodes ago, we did a series where we looked at the revisions that is it Ratliff's annotated Hobbit or the History of the Hobbit? That's what it is. And he's got those chapters in there that Tolkien had written that are like complete revisions of the first three chapters and of the Hobbit. And I think we kind of landed on, you know, I can see why he was trying to do this, but it robs it of a little bit of the magic that we all know is and love is The Hobbit at the same time. Yeah. So
exactly.
I'm glad that he didn't go any further with that, to be honest. Like,
Hobbit
same.
Is good. Yeah.
It's an interesting idea, but I think we're all pretty glad that he didn't, that didn't become the official, you know, the official Hobbit or whatever.
Yeah.
It's I've heard it said it's just best not to mess with the space-time continuum. You know, once it's out there, it's out there.
Yes. I wanted to ask real quick, Holly, I was watching some of your videos on the Word on Fire website, and you were, I forget which one it was, but you were talking about the fact that Tolkien read mystery novels. And I found that very shocking because, I mean, I'll admit I love a good mystery novel. When I read them, I feel a little bit like I'm like they feel kind of fluffy at times, you know, and not that there's anything wrong with fluff. We all need some fluff now and then. But that just really surprised me. And you mentioned Agatha Christie and you mentioned Dorothy Sayers, that he actually read those. Cause I would just, thinking of that complex personality of Tolkien, that's just something very surprising. So speaking, I guess my question is, do you see many influences those mysteries that he would have read in his works at all?
Not specifically, no. I don't see anything in terms of influence. The reason I think they're worth including in the book and thinking about them is that they help us sort of get a more rounded picture of Tolkien. Because he read so widely. We don't want to be reductive and say that everything he read was an influence on what he wrote. I mean, that would be kind of making his creativity into a kind of mechanistic thing. Mm-hmm. He read so much, and honestly, most of it didn't have a direct influence on anything he was writing. Mm-hmm. But when we do look at the whole scope of what he read, it certainly tells some interesting things about him as a thinker, as a creative writer. Mm-hmm. And just the fact, I think it's delightful that he liked
it. Is. Yeah.
His grandson said that he went out of his way to praise Agatha Christie. So he loved Agatha Christie. And it's interesting too, because he loved Agatha Christie. He did not love, according to him, Dorothy Sayers's Peter Wimsey mystery novels. In fact, he ostentatiously, dispraises them. He slams them. And yet, in his comments about how revolting he found, the final volumes, he reveals that he's actually read all of them, all nine. So clearly, we have an instance, I think, of some hyperbole. He's writing to his son, who's actually serving in the Royal Air Force in the middle of World War II. And, he might have just been overstating it for kind of a bit of a fun byplay. Maybe it was a family in-joke or something. Mm-hmm. And he says he enjoys the earlier ones and doesn't like the later ones. Interestingly, the earlier ones are just pure puzzle. It's the later ones we have the romance with Harry Yvain. And also, Tolkien loves the work of G.K. Chesterton. And Chesterton is famous for the creation of the detective Father Brown.
Yes.
Detective. Mm-hmm. And actually, Tolkien didn't like the Father Brown stories. He liked lots of other things he wrote, but not the Father Brown stories. And so it was interesting, because I actually think that it shows that Tolkien really enjoyed the puzzle part of mystery novels, not so much, the sort of character and romance aspect. He just wanted the mystery, he wanted the puzzle. And that's why he liked Agatha Christie, who is the genius of clever plots, and didn't like the later Sayers ones. And of course, Chesterton's Father Brown are all psychological, spiritual, and kind of how they work out the solution. So again, is this influential on Middle Earth? Not at all. Does it shed some light onto another facet of Tolkien's, imagination and his mind, his preferences? Yeah, I think it
absolutely
does.
Yeah, I agree. It just gives you it just kind of broadens your idea of, and shows you kind of what a complicated particular individual he was, but you saw wasn't necessarily what you got all the time.
By the way, Holly, don't, if you saw that wagging finger, that was not for you. We were almost interrupted by one of our children. So
yeah, we forgot to lock the studio.
We usually lock the door for interviews. We forgot to. So we had to do the little wagging finger right there. No, that was not for you.
No hobbits in here, right?
Right. Not at this moment. No.
Not at this moment. Except on party business, right?
Right.
Exactly. Yes. I wanted to mention that remark about the iceberg, because that is, in fact, how Clyde Kilby described Tolkien as an iceberg, that there was a little bit you could see above the surface, but then he had an awareness of a great mass hidden below.
Interesting.
So you actually hit on something that Kilby noticed when he spent a summer with Tolkien attempting to help him get Silmarillion ready for publication. That didn't work, but he spent a summer with him working on that. And Kilby was frankly baffled by Tolkien. He couldn't come, he admired him greatly. He enjoyed working with him. He had huge admiration, but he couldn't figure him out. Mm. And he calls him an iceberg, that he sees there's so much there that is hidden.
So much beneath the surface. Cautionary
tale for literary critics, right? Be careful you bump up against this guy. You're going to get sunk like the Titanic, right? That's great. Yeah. Well, I was just thinking when you said that, to me, Tolkien, that would have been like his, the thing he most wanted to hear, like a critic say about, like, I'm just baffled by this guy. Like Tolkien would have
delighted
in that.
He would have taken pleasure in that, I think, for sure.
Well, the last thing I wanted to mention, with regard to your book is the early bit about, John Henry Cardinal Newman. So as a Catholic convert, we're both Catholic converts. And, I was fascinated to learn that Tolkien has a pretty direct connection to who is now Saint John Henry Cardinal Newman. And for those who don't know, he was a very pivotal figure in English Catholicism in the 19th century. So Holly, can you tell us a little bit more about that connection?
Well, it was fascinating to discover that Tolkien's guardian, Father Francis Morgan, was in fact a personal secretary to Cardinal Newman at the very tail end of Newman's life. So that sheds a bit more light on Father Francis, who is quite a more interesting figure than I think he has been given credit for, hitherto. And he had a great bunch of books in his own rooms at the Oratory. He had a great influence on the young Tolkien. And he was, as I said, a connection to Cardinal Newman. And where Tolkien attended Mass as a boy, spent a lot of time with as a boy under the guardianship of Father Francis, was the Birmingham Oratory, which is the Oratory church founded by John Henry Newman. Mm-hmm. So there's a really direct, they still have Newman's office, his study, preserved in the Oratory exactly as it was. So there's a real connection there between Newman, the Oratory that he founded, Father Francis, and the young Tolkien. And yet, it's enormously frustrating that we don't have any direct evidence of what Tolkien had read of Newman's works. Mm-hmm. And because I took a very strict rule for myself, I could only discuss books that I had evidence he'd actually read, or at least authors that he had evidence that he had read, even in the titles. I couldn't discuss Newman, but I did turn up in my research something that is a genuine discovery. This hasn't been found anywhere. I went up to Durham, England, and looked at the archives of the Newman Association. Now, I knew Douglas Anderson had turned up a letter that Tolkien had co-signed to the Times protesting a religious freedom issue as a vice president of the Newman Association. Mm-hmm. So I knew there was a connection, but there was just that one letter. Well, it turns out that he had been a vice president of the association for a number of years. And he even was involved with the Oxford branch of the Newman Association. He served, he did a talk as part of a little panel in a local group. So far from just being a one-off, signing of a letter, he actually was involved with this group for at least 5 years as a national representative, and even involved with the Oxford branch of it. So he was involved with this Newman Association. Again, kind of also showing that he has an awareness and interest in events outside of just his own, little Oxford, university setting. He's really interested in what's going on in the wider world and in the wider Catholic world. So that was interesting. Mm-hmm. And it just suggests that, of course, he must have known the writings of Newman to be so interested enough to serve as a vice president in this organization. But as yet, we don't know what those titles are. So I commend future researchers, please find out. I would like to know.
Yeah, well, we've definitely done several episodes on Tolkien's religion and, and really trying to do a very careful job of saying how that influenced him and not, just going all in one way or the other. There's too much of that with Tolkien fandom where it's like there's one group of Tolkien fans who are like, everything about Tolkien is his Catholicism. And then there's another group of Tolkien fans is like, just give me Middle Earth. Don't want any of the Catholicism. And it's like, well, you just can't do that with somebody. But Newman is, of course, just very fascinating because he's a historical figure. I mean, in the sense of he's an important guy in history. And I just had not known that Father. I knew of the Birmingham Oratory and that Newman had founded that, but I did not know that Father Francis Morgan was his personal secretary for some period of time. And so just knowing that there's that direct connection between, the two of them. And I agree, Father Francis Morgan, I'm waiting for somebody to write the book about him, because I feel like, especially after the biographical film came out a few years ago, it painted him in a certain light. You can say what you want about that, but it's like, I have a feeling there's a lot more to that guy than, how he was painted in the movie. And, this is a man who was, generous enough to take two boys who weren't his sons and be their father for their teenage years, right?
And to stay as a close family friend through his entire life. And I actually, there is a book on Father Francis. It's called Uncle Kuro by Jose Manuel Friend is Brew. So it has an English translation, Spanish book, English translation. I would recommend that. That's actually where I learned about the Cardinal Newman connection. Now, it doesn't go into as much detail about the Oratorian aspect of it as I would wish. There's lots of scope for more research, but it does give a start, an important start, which I think is absolutely necessary. So Uncle Kuro does set the record straight on some key points about Father Francis and gives a better perspective on him.
Fascinating.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, we've really just scratched the surface of Tolkien's modern reading. In fact, I feel like we may need to have you back on the show again once I've had a chance to finish the entire book. Holly, I really think this book is going to do a great service to correcting a lot of misconceptions about Tolkien, and I'm deeply impressed by the scholarship that's on display in it. I have a master's degree in English. I've read a lot. You know, it's been a while since I was kind of in the middle of academia, but this is an academic work in the best sense of the word. And I feel like from a lot of what I've seen out there, there's less and less of that. There's a lot of stuff that's academic and it's not really great in one way or the other, but this is both readable, but it's also and enjoyable. It's well-written. It's super well researched, and I just love the fact that you are so careful about the methodology and you approach. I think you approach it in a way that does the term academic, you know, and scholarship a lot of service. So I also want to say, the videos for those of you who haven't already bought your copy of this book, what are you waiting for? And if you need more reason to, you just need to visit wordonfire.org/Tolkien. And watch the videos. So, Holly, tell us a little bit about the videos that are on the Word on Fire website.
Well, I spend quite a lot of time in England, and I go over there typically twice a year, have done for the last decade, which, by the way, has been part of how I've kind of gotten a sense of Tolkien, his life, his surroundings. You know, I've gone to Mass in, you know, the same church that he worshipped at, St. Gregory, St. Augustine, you know, been to the Burden Baby, you know, spent time in the Bodleian, all of those things. And it occurred to me that, you know, readers of Tolkien's modern reading might actually enjoy getting a glimpse of the locations where a lot of these things happened. And here I am in England and Oxford. And so I decided, well, I'll make a series of videos that actually give a glimpse of these different locations and to say a little bit about why they matter. And it was really great fun. We ended up making 18, I think, total. And I had some in Birmingham around the oratory, actually in the oratory archives. So I was the very first one. I'm grateful the Oratory Fathers gave me permission to do a video that shows the trunk that Mabel Tolkien brought back from Bloemfontein on their what was supposed to just be a visit to England, but they never went
right.
back.
Right, yeah.
There's one in Beaconsfield, the grave of G.K. Chesterton, but most of them are set in all different places in Oxford, you know, C.S. Lewis's, the church where C.S. Lewis worshipped and where he's buried, Holywell Cemetery, where Charles Williams is buried, the Bodleian Library, Christ Church, which has a connection with Lewis Carroll, the Dragon School, you know, all sorts of places. There's even, you know, the River Charwell, where I talk a little about the Wind in the Willows. So I found lots of different places where I wanted to be able to show a glimpse of, this is a place that Tolkien knew, that he lived, or that he walked by, or that he worked in, or what have you. And here is some insight or thought about his reading that I can share with my audience related to that. So it was great fun to do. Yeah. And I do hope that folks will enjoy seeing them, kind of a little video preview of all that I've been working on.
Yeah. And they're beautifully done.
Yeah. Well produced.
Yeah.
For
very
sure.
Well produced.
And,
yeah.
and they're nice little kind of bite-sized, you know, you know, it each of them is about a couple of minutes, but there's several of them. And so it's a really, it's almost like a little video introduction to the topics you're going to explore, you know, you explore in the book. So, but I'll make sure and link to the website in the show notes so you all can go check it out. And so you can learn more about, you can learn more about getting your copy of Tolkien's Modern Reading by visiting wordonfire.org/Tolkien. So, Holly, I wanted to pivot, just to kind of a more general fandom discussion. This is always fun to do whenever we have fellow Tolkien fans on the show. And just, you know, talk about the kind of things that Tolkien fans talk about in general. So first off, do you have a favorite Tolkien character or two or three?
Oh, well, that's a tough question. As you added, there were two or three. You know, I have to say, I probably would say my favorite is Sam, because who cannot love Sam? Tolkien called him the hero of the Lord of the Rings. Sam has a special place in my heart. And then this would probably not shock you. Probably after that, Eowyn is a character that I just particularly love.
Sure. Yeah.
So those are my two highlights.
Those are good ones for sure. Yeah. Do you have a favorite work or a part of a work of Tolkien's?
Oh,
well, you've already mentioned Lord of the Rings, obviously. And it's kind of like to say Lord of the Rings is like, you know, well, obviously Lord of the Rings, but any particular part, or if there another, like another of his works that you'd maybe want to highlight and say something about?
Well, I would say within Lord of the Rings, I think a chapter that I keep kind of finding more resonance on is the Cormallen chapter after the rescue of the Fields of Cormallen, after the rescue of Frodo and Sam, because I think, you know, especially the more I've reread it, I feel like that scene just has a perfect balance of just the beauty, the sorrow, the homely, and the high notes. I think it's just exquisite. And it's placed just so beautifully that I think a lesser writer would have made that the end of the book. Frodo and Sam have been rescued, the ring has been destroyed. And yet Tolkien, in his, frankly, his great wisdom, you know, through his life that he experienced so much, he knew that the high point actually means you still have to carry on after that. And so we see them, you know, seeing how things are playing out, seeing how things have to be built up, and then the going home and the just so painful scenes of the scouring of the Shire. And if it doesn't break your heart to see the party tree cut down, like, what are you made of? You know, so I think that the Fields of Cormallen just kind of highlights his gift, because he brings us to this peak and it's so moving. And yet he doesn't let us stay there. He then takes us on to kind of, well, in life, we have to deal with cleaning up afterwards, and things don't all fall out perfectly. And then he gives us the final ending, and then the just pitch perfect note of Sam coming home and saying, well, I'm back. So I just love that.
Just what an incredible, like, final line of the book, right? It's like, you know, you wrote this incredible epic, and then the final thing is this, well, I'm back. Perfect, like, understated, like, just the most understated notes you can have. But you also mentioned the Fields of Cormallen, isn't it that chapter where we have Sam waking up and he sees Gandalf, and then he says his great line, is everything sad going to come untrue, right? Which is just like, again, Sam, like, what can you not love about Sam, right? And it's such a brilliant moment.
Gives me chills every time.
I know, there's one of the two of the all-time great lines of Tolkien, both delivered by Sam. So
well, I think we all know who Tolkien's favorite Lord of the Rings character was. I'm just saying,
could he pick just one? I mean, but, you know, it's like they're all his kids, right? I mean,
they
it's
are.
Like
that's true. That is true.
So and then kind of getting more into the pop culture aspects of it. You know, what are your opinion of the Jackson films? I'm assuming you've seen them. It's been so long at this point, you know, since they came out, but what are your kind of general thoughts on the Jackson films as being, you know, since you're a Tolkien scholar?
Yeah. The Lord of the Rings films, I on the whole have a positive view of. We will not speak of the Hobbit films.
Not going to go. I had somebody recommend to me the other day, one of our patrons actually recommended to me that there's some fan edits of the Hobbit out there, which I have not seen any of these, but apparently somebody edited it down to one movie, all three movies down to one movie, to try and make it a proper adaptation of the Hobbit itself.
Oh.
And he said there's one or two that are actually pretty good. And that speaks to the power of editing, which has been kind of one of the sub themes, of this episode, especially when we were talking about Carpenter, but it'd be interesting maybe to go back and watch that at some point and see if it improves the viewing of of the Hobbit. Have you been following, you know, the really big news about the Amazon TV show, and, you know, kind of, you know, the development that's been going on with that? Any thoughts that you want to share on that? And feel free to say none, but if you got some, share them.
Yeah, I've been very lightly following it in the sense that I'm aware that it's going on, but I'm content to kind of sit back and sort of see what comes of it. You know, I don't have a problem with adaptation as a general principle, and I don't think Tolkien would have either, because he talks about doing a mythology for England, and he explicitly says that he's imagining it as something that people can add to in art and drama and all that. So I think that he would not have been averse to the principle of adaption and doing these things. Now, I think he would want them to be done well,
no doubt.
And consistent with his overall ethos. So it's not, you know, it's not just anything goes. So I think we'll wait and see. I think the Lord of the Rings films, the extended editions, I think, are better than the theatrical cuts. I think you get more. I think they're pretty good. I don't think they're definitive. I hope that in, you know, 30 years time, we'll get, you know, another version. I think they're good. And they capture a lot of what Tolkien was doing. They do miss some parts of what he's doing. I think some pretty important parts. And I think Jackson somewhat misunderstands Tolkien's ideas of what makes a hero. He adds in a certain element of sort of angst that isn't really quite what Tolkien's getting at.
Right.
And Tolkien doesn't have it. Tolkien's heroes are not cardboard. You know, Aragorn has a lot of doubts about what he's doing. Is he doing the right thing in The Lord of the Rings, in the book itself? He's not like this cardboard man of confidence, but he also isn't like an internally conflicted, you know, angsty.
Yeah.
You know, so I think Jackson doesn't quite grasp some of what Tolkien's getting at in terms of character. And I think he gets a little carried away by the possibilities of what CGI can do, especially in The Return of the King. But I think there's a lot to like, and the music is just fantastic.
Oh yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
And it has brought a lot of people to come to The Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
Now that does raise some interesting questions about how people receive The Lord of the Rings. And I'll just name one interesting thing that gets a footnote in Tolkien's Modern Reading. In The Lord of the Rings, Sam is repeatedly described as having brown skin. He's very clearly dark skinned. It's named several times, his brown hands.
Interesting.
And Sam in Jackson's film is white. He's white and has reddish blonde hair. And I think that's a really subtle detail that actually shapes our perception of Tolkien and his views about race. Tiny detail. In the book, Denethor, who's very much a bad guy, is described as having ivory skin. And yeah, he's just a sort of ordinary looking guy in the films. Is this a big thing? Probably not. Is it interesting to note how it shifts people's perceptions of characters? Yeah, I think it does. I think it makes a difference if we realize that Tolkien envisioned the hero of The Lord of the Rings as being dark-skinned. You know, I just think that's interesting.
Wow.
Yeah, really fascinating. It really is. And not that I want to open this can of worms at this point, but because there is, you know, there is so much conversation about issues of race, you know, going on in the world right now and has been for, you know, the better part of the last year. You know, it's interesting to hear those clarifications, because it would indicate that, you know, making, you know, if he makes this darker skinned character the hero of the story, right? You know, like, and this ivory skinned character, like this, like total, you know, just waste, you know, like this guy that's just like, what is wrong with this guy? It kind of turns on the head. I feel like there is a threat out there that wants to make Tolkien out to be something he's not. And when in fact, I think especially for his time, he was actually fairly progressive on such things, on such
visionary
issues, right?
Yeah.
Here's an interesting fact in that regard. I turned up, again, looking at context, it turns out that he denounces apartheid in his retirement speech to the University of Oxford before the British Anti-Apartheid Society had even been formed.
Wow.
So he comes out and says, I detest apartheid and all of its forms, before it was a known, like, before it was a big public issue. And he does this in his valedictory speech, which was a big deal. It had a full house. It was reported in the news. Now, it's only a passing comment, and he swiftly moves on. But Tolkien actually understood Oxford academic politics very well. He followed the academic politics in a way that Lewis totally was oblivious to. And Tolkien knew that a single barbed line like that was going to hit home. You know, he calls it out, and he moves on, but he calls it out in the most public speech of his entire academic career. And this is, again, I looked at the dates. This is, apartheid had only been in effect for 10 years. And it was even before there was a big public opinion against it. And it was later, you know,
That would have been like the late 50s or early 60s when he made that. I think it was the early 60s when he made that speech. But yeah, I mean, it was certainly well before, like, the, I remember the anti-apartheid movement like as an 80s thing. So it was certainly well before that.
He makes it even before there was any formal organization in Britain to be against apartheid, he spoke up. And, you know, I think that says something about Tolkien, that that he uses his opportunity, you know, to make that point. Again, not to belabor it, because it's not what his speech was about, but to make the point publicly. And then, you know.
Well, we did an episode on Tolkien versus the Nazis. And I actually did a YouTube video on this topic because, you know, again, it's you just hear all these weird things that people come up with and want to kind of, you know, label him or, you know, just that you're just like, that cannot be right. And then you do the research and it's like, well, you know, actually, when you look at the things that Tolkien said about the Nazis and even to the Nazis, like, he was actually like putting himself at risk. Like, he was taking significant risk to be anti-Nazi before it was cool to be anti-Nazi, you know? And, you know, so it's, I just love discovering these things because it just, we're not very partial. We love Tolkien on this show. And so, like, you know, it's just furthermore, like, yep, he just loved this man so much.
And then, you know, it just fleshes out just like your book. I mean, it fleshes out your, you know, Tolkien as a person, as an individual, and really gives you just, you know, a really like an idea of how well-rounded he really was and how there was just, you know, just like almost like his legendarium that he created, that he himself was just kind of limitless in a way, you know, he was just, you know, he could, yeah, just fascinating.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Holly, thank you so much for visiting us on the Tolkien Road.
Yes, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a lot of fun discussing really Tolkien's modern reading and all things Tolkien. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we can have you on again in the near future.
Well, I would love to.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome.
Fantastic. All right. Well, we want to give a shout out again to our patrons. Thank you all so much for supporting us, especially the following: Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Lise U,
Andrew T,
John R,
Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Asia V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Matt L,
Johanna T,
Ms. Anonymous,
Sam N,
Mike M. And we also want to give a shout out to those celebrating their patron anniversary in February: Asia V,
Chuck F,
Eric B,
Ish of the Hammer,
and John R. And thank you, Holly, for listening to our list of our litany of thanking our patrons there.
Yes.
We may need to come up with a better system for future interviews. I don't know. So yeah, I feel kind of bad having our guests sit through all that. So, but these are the people
support. So good for them. Hooray. Read their names out.
Right on. Thanks, Holly. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. And we will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye. Thank you.